Here's what Between the Lines featured last week.
What started with the whistleblower and the allegations related to urging foreign interference are so stunning and just so shocking that it's really what pushed Congress into starting this impeachment inquiry. So many people to look at, so many people to call, and there's campaign finance violations, abuse of power issues.
The Chilean salary is very, very low. For example, it sometimes can reach maybe $450. And the pensions are very, very bad. So what most people are protesting against is against the how this system is creating a gap between the richest and between more and more people who are becoming poor.
And the vast, vast majority of the other 2.9% of climate scientists that don't agree with that, the vast majority of them are funded by fossil fuel interests.
Here's what we're featuring this week on Between the Lines on Progressive Voices Network.
Unless there is a democratic revival in Bolivia, the right-wing forces will, again, with the support of the armed forces, the police, and so on, will regain the upper hand and control, with brute force, the political situation in Bolivia.
If Dr. Warren is convicted, it will act as a deterrent to people helping those in need, and then more people will be suffering and dying in the borderland.
The Chicago Teachers Union sort of took the opportunity of its contract negotiations to essentially urge the mayor to urge Chicago Public School District to support the push for rent control, highlighting the ways that, the issues of affordable housing and homelessness. There are 17,000 homeless students in the Chicago school system, issues that teachers see in the classroom every day.
All that's next on Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, heard here on Progressive Voices Network, Saturday 2 to 3 p.m. and Sunday 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Andres Arauz, Senior Research Fellow with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who describes the coup that overthrew Bolivia's socialist president Evo Morales, Latin America's first indigenous head of state. Celia Bavier of the humanitarian aid group No More Deaths, who talks about the Trump Justice Department's prosecution of Scott Warren for providing humanitarian aid to migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. And Rebecca Burns of In These Times magazine, who discusses her coverage of the 11-day Chicago teachers strike and how the union's bargaining for the common good could be a harbinger for change within the U.S. labor movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In Argentina's mountainous Patagonia region, home to the indigenous Mapuche people, fracking wells dot the harsh landscape. The land shook on September 14th when a fracking well exploded and burned for 24 days, releasing natural gas and other toxic elements into the air. According to the Guardian newspaper, fracking accidents occur regularly in Vaca Muerta, one of the world's largest shale oil and gas reserves. In 2018, the area experienced over 900 fracking incidents. Local residents complain of leaks from wells, resulting in water pollution and illness, including cancer. Moreover, livestock from the indigenous community are dying in surprising numbers. However, Argentina's leaders boast the shale boom will revive the South American nation's ailing economy through partnerships with energy giants like Chevron. The indigenous Mapuche people claim the fracking wells have only brought them poor health, discrimination, and dispossession. Indigenous leaders say they were denied land rights on the plateau, where they have grazed cattle and goats for a century, the same land where 500 fracking wells now operate. In early 2019, the Trump administration laid out its strategy to deny China's pick to lead the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, based in Rome. In the spring, as the U.S. and European Union split over which candidate to back, China's candidate, Ku Dongzhu, captured a majority of votes to lead the FAO. The U.S.-backed candidate, Georgia's former agriculture minister, David Kovrelidze, came in third. China's win over the U.S. and the EU is testament to the nation's rising influence at the UN. The Trump regime has pared back its funding and clout at the United Nations, withdrawing from key UN bodies. China has stepped in to fill the void, securing broad support for the crown jewel of President Xi Jinping's foreign policy, the Belt and Road Initiative. Foreign Policy magazine reports that of the 15 specialized agencies at the UN, Chinese nationals now head four of them. France, the United Kingdom, and the United States each lead one, though the three Western powers continue to hold monopolies on the most influential UN jobs, overseeing peacekeeping, humanitarian relief, and political affairs. In April, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee put together a blacklist of campaign consultants who are working for insurgent Democrats challenging incumbents. In These Times magazine reports that the Democratic Campaign Committee's directive stated that any consultant, polling firm, communication strategist, or field operative that helped insurgent challengers would be ineligible for future work with the DCCC, practically forcing them to steer clear of any insurgent if they ever wanted to work on a Democratic congressional campaign again. One of the early victims of the blacklist was Marie Newman, who is running a progressive campaign against anti-choice conservative Democratic incumbent Representative Dan Lipinski in Chicago. She supports reproductive rights, Medicare for all, the Green New Deal, and a $15 minimum wage. After losing to Lipinski in 2018 by just over 2%, Newman could be poised for an upset over Lipinski. Newman is out fundraising the incumbent and could benefit from higher turnout of infrequent voters in a presidential election year. Longtime Chicago observer Dick Simpson says a Newman victory could unleash the energy of grassroots activists to take on entrenched incumbents inside the Democratic Party across the country. Newman is now working with Justice Democrats who played a key role in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's surprise 2018 primary win in New York City. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After 3 weeks of sometimes violent protests that left three dead and many injured, Bolivia's president Evo Morales was forced from power in a coup. On November 10th, Morales, Latin America's first indigenous head of state, and his vice president Alvaro Garcia announced their forced resignation and fled to the city of Cochabamba in central Bolivia. Morales later traveled to Mexico, where he's been granted political asylum. Protests followed the October 20th national election, which the Bolivian opposition had charged was manipulated by electoral authorities, to declare Morales the first-round victor. The Washington-dominated Organization of American States had published a report alleging irregularities that impacted the official vote count. But analysis by the Center for Economic and Policy Research has cast doubt on those findings, warning against what it called the politicization of the electoral observation process. Both the commander-in-chief of Bolivia's military and head of the Bolivian police requested in no uncertain terms the resignation of Morales. The coup forces, led by pro-Santa Cruz Committee President Luis Fernando Camacho, continues to target Morales' Movement for Socialism Party activists, progressive social movements, and the majority indigenous peoples of the nation. Your reporter spoke with Andres Arauz, senior research fellow with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a former minister of knowledge in the Ecuador government, and former central bank general director. Reached in Mexico City, where he's pursuing a PhD in economics, Arauz describes the actors in the coup that overthrew Bolivia's socialist president.
Now, this has led to a power vacuum in Bolivia. The vice president also resigned in solidarity with the president. So the line of succession is broken because there is nobody to be in charge of the presidency of the Bolivian government.
And the congressional authorities that were supposed to be lines of succession have also resigned due to pressures from the opposition. There is apparently the second vice president of the Senate, an opposition leader. She is supposedly next in the line of succession, but the opposition protesters that have been leading the coup, especially Camacho from Santa Cruz, has said that somebody else needs to take in charge, and of course he's volunteered himself. Now, he's a person that is extremely right-wing. He belongs to Nazi groups in Santa Cruz. He is also part of the commercial and economic elite of Santa Cruz. He's a landowner. And he is what you may call a religious fanatic by, for example, taking the Bible and putting it on top of the Bolivian flag when he took over the presidential palace. It is expected that even if he's not actually in charge of the presidency, he may be the one actually running the country right now. Of course, he has no democratic mandate whatsoever. He was not elected at all, but he's the one exerting power right now. And he has asked the military that had not participated in any way by repressing protesters till today, he has asked the military to intervene and to exert force against the leftist campesinos that are now protesting against the coup d'etat, that are primarily from the countryside and from the Bolivian city of El Alto, which is just outside of La Paz, the capital city.
Andres, what do we know about any U.S. support for this apparent coup d'etat in Bolivia?
Well, there have been some pronouncements by the Trump administration congratulating the opposition forces for quote-unquote democracy. I don't know what kind of democracy there is. If Evo won the last elections, we may question whether he won by the just enough margin for a round, for a second round, not to be necessary, but it was obvious that he had more votes than Mesa, even the OAS electoral supervisory mission admits so. We have also had some announcements by Marco Rubio, by the Attorney General, by the U.S. Attorney General, and of course by Mike Pompeo, all congratulating the Bolivian opposition for this. So even if the U.S. doesn't play an active role, which has been constant in the case of Bolivian history for the 20th century, throughout the 20th century, even these words that are encouraging the Bolivian coup plotters perhaps were not necessary in a civilized 21st century democracy.
Andres, who would the potential winners and losers be in a civil war in Bolivia that pits the indigenous population that supports Evo Morales and his MAS party against the regionally centered conservative opposition groups?
The Bolivian campesinos and indigenous majority has lived under repression from right-wing forces and conservative politicians, not in the last 24 hours, but more something like the last 500 years. Please recall that Evo Morales was the first indigenous president in an overwhelmingly indigenous majority population. So this is the first indigenous president in an indigenous country. And Evo Morales is really more like the figure of Nelson Mandela, who has been imprisoned for multiple times before he was ever a candidate or a politician, precisely because he led resistance against neoliberal or right-wing governments throughout the 20th century and the early 21st century. So, like even Evo Morales said, and his vice president, García Linera, the indigenous peoples are actually used to being the underdogs, are used to being the ones that are repressed and that face, the armed forces in very asymmetric terms. So it is widely expected that unless there is a democratic revival in Bolivia, the right-wing forces will, again, with the support of the armed forces, the police, and so on, will regain the upper hand and control with brute force the political situation in Bolivia. In economic terms, it will mean an aggressive extractivist project primarily based on the expansion of the agriculture into the Amazon. Camacho is a landowner that supports expansion of the agricultural frontier into the Amazon, having devastating ecological consequences. And of course, in the macroeconomic side, there is no doubt that a right-wing government would simply adopt the IMF agenda, which is clearly set out for Bolivia in its last report from December 2018.
That was Andres Arauz, senior research fellow with the Center for Economic and Policy Research and Ecuador's former Minister of Knowledge and Central Bank General Director. Find more analysis and commentary on the Bolivian coup by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Suffering and death at the U.S.-Mexico border is hard to fathom for those who don't know what the desert is like. Thirst, intense heat, stings from poisonous scorpions, and exhaustion have led to 3,000 immigrant deaths in the Arizona border region since 2000. 6,000 more across the entire border region from California to Texas, plus an estimated 4,000 people who've died in the desert but whose remains were never found. Humanitarian aid groups have been deploying emergency supplies of water, canned food, clothing, and other survival items along migrant trails for decades. In early 2019, four volunteers with the group No More Deaths, No Más Muertes were convicted of multiple misdemeanors for providing emergency supplies to migrants. Earlier in January 2018, federal authorities arrested another No More Deaths volunteer, Scott Warren, and charged him with two counts of harboring migrants and one count of conspiracy. They also arrested the two immigrants whom Warren had given the humanitarian aid. His trial in June ended with a hung jury, 8-4 in favor of acquittal. But in July, the Trump Justice Department decided to retry him, dropping the conspiracy charge. If convicted, Warren faces 5 years in prison on each count of harboring. His second trial began on November 12th in Tucson. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Celia Bavier, fundraising coordinator with No More Deaths, who discusses Scott Warren's case and the larger story of the life and death struggles on the U.S.-Mexico border.
We've gotten a huge amount of support. We've done a huge canvassing campaign for the last, almost basically year leading up to the trial. And we did that to reach out to people and just let them know about the trial and the conditions along the border and about the work that these humanitarian organizations that are doing that's so important. And we've just received an overwhelming amount of support by canvassing door-to-door, people putting up signs, people writing letters to the editor, showing up at the courthouse. Nationally, we've received a huge amount of support. We had 133,000 people sign a petition back in June to support his work, saying that humanitarian aid should never be a crime. We've got the United Nations to submit a statement, Amnesty International, and 15 senators signed a letter in his support and in support of other humanitarian aid volunteers. So, yes, I mean, we've gotten just a huge outcry. And fundraising has increased, too, because of that, just showing the support. So the trial, the new trial, starts Tuesday, November 12th. We expect it to go about 2 weeks. We have people going out to the desert every single day to weave water and food and medical supplies. And we have a couple of more organized days, I guess you would say, where we have people like out of town visitors that will be joining them. People that might not normally do that, they'll be coming into town to do that. And we will be having a Faith Floods the Courthouse day on Wednesday, November 20th, where we'll have faith leaders from across southern Arizona, but also from across the country, come into town to give support from the faith community. One of Scott's defenses in the case is that he is acting on his strongly held religious beliefs to do this work. So that is a component of the trial. And he has obtained huge support from faith communities of different types across the country.
Celia Bavier, when these humanitarian groups started ramping up along the border around 2001, Volunteers were finding hundreds of migrants a day in need of help. And now, with all the Trump policies in place to discourage migration, the numbers have plummeted. How common is it to find migrants in the desert these days?
We're out doing humanitarian aid every day. I can't honestly tell you how common that is. I know it's happening continually. People are crossing over only because we have a search and rescue group who gets calls every day, as does the Pima County Sheriff's Department. They get calls every day from people that are lost or from their families who are calling them from their countries of origin saying that we have not heard from such and such since this date, and they are either lost in the desert trying to cross over, or they are lost in Mexico getting ready to cross over, or they are in the detention system and lost. So while you're right, I think the numbers may have gone down in terms of people crossing because people are being held in Mexico and all that. People are also just continually trying to cross. And because they're being held in Mexico, I think this is just anecdotal evidence at this point, but we think people may try to cross over more. That migrant protocol policy, has not happened in Arizona yet. So as of right now, in the border crossings here, migrants are not kept in Mexico officially like they are in Texas and California. But if and when that changes, you know, the whole migration pattern could change as well. Because if people are forced to stay in unsafe places in Mexico, they're more tempted to just try to come over on their own instead of waiting for that official hearing.
Any last thoughts on Scott Warren's trial?
Our big fear is if he's convicted, it will have a chilling effect on giving aid, not just along the border, but in many circumstances to people that are undocumented or uncertain status. And we have to help all people in need, whether they're in the borderlands or not. And if Dr. Warren is convicted, it will act as a deterrent to people helping those in need, and then more people will be suffering and dying in the borderlands.
That was Celia Bavier, fundraising coordinator with the group No More Deaths. Learn more about Scott Warren's case and groups working for his acquittal by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When 32,000 Chicago Public School teachers and aides went on strike in the nation's third largest school district with 360,000 students on October 17th, there was broad public support. The first major walkout in the city since a strike in 2012 came after 10 months of talks with Mayor Lori Lightfoot failed to resolve differences over pay and benefits, class size, and a demand for fairly compensated school support staff. The teachers' union also demanded the city launch a program to expand affordable housing. After 11 days on the picket line in the rain and snow, teachers returned to school on November 1st. The strike had succeeded in winning teacher pay increases and an agreement to place a social worker and nurse in every school. However, the union failed to make progress on their demand that the city initiate programs to expand affordable housing. Your reporter spoke with Rebecca Burns, contributing editor at In These Times magazine, who discusses her coverage of the Chicago teachers' strike and how the union's focus on social justice issues affecting their communities, known as bargaining for the common good, could be a harbinger for change within the U.S. labor movement.
So this is the longest teachers' strike that Chicago has seen in decades, longer than the landmark 2012 strike that the Chicago teachers' union went on. And they were campaigning for a number of issues that related to classroom learning conditions, so things like class size, and also issues that kind of spoke to broader issues facing students, so staffing for social workers, nurses, counselors. And finally, I think the strike was really unique and avant-garde in that, the Chicago Teachers Union has been a proponent of what's called bargaining for the common good, or sort of an orientation to contract negotiations that really brings in the concerns and the issues of the broader community. The teachers union was also pushing affordable housing as one of its contract demands in a way that I think we haven't seen in quite some time, and that really sort of started conversations here in the city. And I should note, one of the other things that was really notable this time around was that it was not just the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, that was on strike, but another union, SEIU Local 73, that represents janitors, bus aides, special education assistants.
And Rebecca, as you talked to union members after the strike concluded, were they satisfied that their time out from work was worth the effort, worth all the organizing that they'd been engaged in for months and months? Did they feel the outcome was worth their effort?
Yeah, well, I think there are sort of two parts to that answer. The first is, yes, definitely. I think people are incredibly proud of the fact that they won, really for the first time, a guarantee that by 2023, every school will have a nurse and a social worker. They won, I think the average was 40% pay bumps for paraprofessional staff who, in many cases, are making poverty wages, as well as pay bumps for special education assistants and other support staff who 2/3 of their children qualified for reduced lunch because of the low wages they were making. So there were significant gains around issues of staffing, to a lesser degree class sizes, also bilingual education and special education that really clearly wouldn't have happened had these unions not gone on strike. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part that I think strikers are very much cognizant of is that these still are really basic guarantees that a lot of, in Illinois, suburban school districts already enjoy. Just asking for things like a nurse in every school really seems sort of so fundamental that I think even at the same time that people are proud of the strike they went on, there's sort of some reflection on why it took that kind of sort of monumental effort just to win those basics.
At the outset, Rebecca, you mentioned that the Chicago Teachers Union had not only campaigned for internal issues related to their day-to-day work in the school system in Chicago, but also on a common good agenda, a social justice mm-hmm. agenda for Chicago and the communities that they live in and teach in. And this was a departure from most union organizing these days. It may have been that unions took on these bigger social issues back when unions were in their heyday, and certainly in the 30s when organizing was met by armed force and repression. But that hasn't been the face of labor unions for quite some time now.
That's right. The CTU's 2012 strike really helped sort of spark the wave of both more militant teacher uprisings that we've been seeing, as well as sort of a renewed orientation among a lot of progressive unions towards this idea that bargaining is, not just about pay and benefits, but an opportunity to raise these broader social issues and to sort of wield the power that unions have to try and address them. So, a really concrete example is that, Chicago, like many other cities, doesn't have rent control, in part because of a state law that preempts cities from legislating around this issue. The Chicago Teachers Union sort of took the opportunity of its contract negotiations to essentially urge the mayor to support the push for rent control and to urge Chicago Public School District to support the push for rent control, highlighting the ways that, the issues of affordable housing and homelessness, there are 17,000 homeless students in the Chicago school system, how those really related fundamentally to issues that teachers see in the classroom every day.
That was Rebecca Burns, contributing editor at In These Times magazine. Find links to her coverage of the Chicago teacher strike and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Casts, Castro, CastBox, Podchaser, and dozens of community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris. And now we hear an encore presentation of Between the Lines, featuring timely, in-depth progressive analysis. Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Beth Rotman of Common Cause, who discusses the Democrats' narrow approach to impeachment, focusing on Trump's abuse of presidential power for personal political gain, and the Republican effort to upend the process. Jose Ragas, assistant professor at Chile's Catholic University in Santiago, who examines the economic conditions that led to militant and massive protests against inequality and demands for change in Chile. And independent journalist Dar Jamal, who talks about his new book titled The End of ICE, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amidst the recent eruption of protests against inequality, austerity, and corruption in Chile, Ecuador, Iraq, and Lebanon, the U.S. media has focused little attention on Haiti after a deepening economic crisis and growing fuel and food shortages have triggered militant street demonstrations. Protesters in the impoverished Caribbean nation are demanding the resignation of U.S.-backed President Jovenel Moise. Supporters of President Moise are calling on the United States, which has militarily intervened in Haiti many times in decades past, to send money, food aid, and logistical support to prop up the faltering regime. For almost 3 months, most banks, businesses, and schools have remained closed as the crisis in Haiti deepens. President Moise backed the Trump administration's campaign to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and recognize opposition leader Juan Guaido as the nation's legitimate president. This was a dramatic break with Haiti's previous policy, where the country was a major beneficiary of the Venezuelan government's Petrocaribe program, which sold 60,000 barrels of oil per day to Haiti at a steep discount, half of which could then be repaid at 1% interest over 25 years. But large-scale corruption swallowed billions of dollars of profits from the oil program. Venezuela halted oil shipments to Haiti in March 2018, triggering oil shortages. The International Monetary Fund then demanded the end of fuel subsidies in exchange for an economic bailout, which sparked massive street protests, deepening an already dire crisis. After 5 months of mass pro-democracy protests, Hong Kong has fallen into a recession. Tourism has fallen to its lowest level since the SARS viral pandemic in 2003, and some workers from mainland China in the city are now looking to relocate to Beijing and Shanghai. As pro-democracy activists decry police brutality, they're also pushing back against what they see as Beijing's growing attempts to tighten its grip over Hong Kong, creating a groundswell of anti-China sentiment. Activists have taken aim at some of China's largest banks during the protests, smashing windows, spray-painting anti-China slogans on shuttered branches, and trashing ATM machines. Some mainlanders, as they are called, say they plan to leave the city, while others say they dare not go out on weekends when the protests regularly escalate. Tensions have long existed between Hong Kong natives and a million mainland Chinese who live and work in the city. Many in the former British colony blame mainlanders for pushing up property prices and clogging streets and shopping malls. 51 million mainland tourists visited the city in 2018, nearly seven times Hong Kong's population of 7.4 million. Leading 2020 presidential candidate Bernie Sanders gave some tough love to Israel during the annual J Street conference in a hall packed with liberal Democrats. Sanders laid out his views on putting real conditions on Washington's $3.8 billion annual military aid package to Israel. Yet House Democrats, led by Speaker Nancy Pelosi, have proclaimed their solidarity with Israel in condemning the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, or BDS. J Street, the liberal counterweight to the powerful American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is the self-proclaimed pro-Israel, pro-peace organization. During his appearance, Sanders, the only Jewish candidate in the 2020 campaign, warned of the dangers of white supremacy and racism before criticizing Israeli military operations in Gaza as absolutely inhumane. Sanders promised to leverage U.S. military aid to Israel to demand respect for human rights and democracy, but did not lay out a detailed strategy. Israel and its close allies are working to undermine their nation's critics, including a campaign to defund the BDS movement. According to In These Times magazine, Israeli officials are engaged with a network of allied nonprofits to curtail support for pro-Palestinian groups, including the U.S. Presbyterian Church and the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers Union. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The House of Representatives voted along party lines on October 31st to formally begin the impeachment inquiry against President Donald Trump, only the fourth president in U.S. history to face a formal impeachment investigation. The 232-196 vote included only two Democrats who opposed the measure. The resolution spelled out the rules for the impeachment process that includes releasing transcripts of closed-door interviews, giving Democratic and Republican committee lawyers equal time to ask questions and cross-examine witnesses in public hearings, but will deny Trump representatives' request to call witnesses if the White House continues to block testimony and documents Congress demands. At the same time, Trump's GOP defenders criticized the impeachment rules. Many, along with the president, are demanding to know the identity of the intelligence whistleblower who made the initial complaint about Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, a clearly unethical effort to bully and intimidate the whistleblower and others who may testify against the president. Multiple witnesses have already offered testimony, substantiating Trump's abuse of presidential power for personal political gain. Your reporter spoke with Beth Rotman, Money and Politics and Ethics Program Director with Common Cause. Here she assesses the Democrats' approach to impeachment, narrowly focused on Trump's apparent effort to use extortion tactics to pressure Ukraine President Zelensky to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter, as well as alleged Ukraine involvement in the 2016 presidential election.
I think it's important that we remember that our elections are really the cornerstone of our democracy. So these allegations of the president, the highest elected official in our country, who were looking at really significant allegations of encouraging foreign interference in our elections, it really gets at the core of what we are as a country. And that's really why it's so incredibly significant, but also that there's really a lot left to do. Because of the natures of the allegations and because things have started in the various security organizations, so much of what's happened so far has been closed to the public because of the sensitive nature. That said, what's really happened now is at least enough has been substantiated that Congress has said, okay, we have to open this up. And now we have to have a full impeachment inquiry that's really much more transparent and open to the public. So certainly that it's been along partisan lines, but we're really at the beginning. So a lot is still coming out, and I think that a lot of this story is yet to be written.
Beth, as it's been discussed in our media and among people all over the country, there's speculation about how many articles of impeachment are likely to come out of the House of Representatives when this is all done in terms of this inquiry. And it looks like Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, is predisposed to focus only on the Ukraine scandal, the extortion of information damaging to President Trump's political opponents, namely former Vice President Joe Biden, vis-a-vis his son and his work in Ukraine at the Burisma gas company. But I'm wondering, from your perspective, is it undercutting the case for impeachment if Nancy Pelosi and the majority of Democrats back only one article of impeachment focusing solely on the Ukraine scandal and not taking into account the other apparent violations of the Constitution that have been well documented that include abuse of power, the emoluments clause, possibly bribery, and obstruction of justice that was certainly enumerated in the Mueller report?
What started with the whistleblower and the allegations related to urging foreign interference are so stunning and so shocking that it's really what pushed Congress into starting this impeachment inquiry. I mean, it really was a moment, and I think we heard a lot of our leaders saying, wow, you know, the times have called us. Anybody who is on the fence, now there was a majority to start this impeachment inquiry. I think that things still could be further opened up. I don't think it's undercutting it. I tend to look at it as it may make sense. You know, even with keeping it a bit on the more narrow side, there is still so, so much. I mean, there's so many people to look at, so many people to call, and there's still abuse of power issues, and all of those things come into it, including we're seeing campaign finance violations, abuse of power violations that are potential here. All of these things are coming into it, even with looking at this sort of piece, which we've called the tip of the iceberg. So I think that, you know, starting on the more narrow side and then later potentially expanding is also okay.
Beth, what are some of your concerns at Common Cause about how the Republican Party, which has stayed pretty loyal to Trump throughout this process over the last couple of years of many investigations, what are the concerns about how they will try to derail the impeachment process by claiming that there's an unfair process, by basically saying Trump did nothing illegal, and that the charges against Donald Trump in this impeachment inquiry thus far, many Republicans say, doesn't justify impeachment? But could there be other political maneuvers and parliamentary maneuvers that are used to undermine the entire impeachment process?
This is really a fight for the soul of our country and to protect our democracy. So Common Cause is working in coalition with a lot of other nonpartisan organizations to urge all of our elected officials to do this the right way. And we have seen these critical moments in our country's history in the past where things started in a more partisan way, but then they improved because at the end of the day, our elected officials are responsible to all of us. And this is not a partisan moment.
That was Beth Rotman, Money and Politics and Ethics Program Director with Common Cause. For more analysis and commentary on the impeachment inquiry against Donald Trump, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent weeks, Chile has witnessed some of the largest protests in its modern history, along with some of the worst examples of brutal government repression since the Pinochet military dictatorship ended in 1990.
Student protests in opposition to a government-imposed 3% hike in subway fares in early October triggered a nationwide protest movement demanding economic and political change to address the nation's extreme economic inequality. Along with mostly peaceful protests, there were acts of vandalism and looting, which led the government of Chilean President Sebastián Piñera to declare a state of emergency on October 18th. At least 20 people have died in clashes between police and protesters. Although the government withdrew the fare hike, protests have continued and grown, culminating in a massive march in the nation's capital, Santiago, of more than 1 million people from across all sectors of Chilean society on October 25th. The social unrest has resulted in the cancellation of two international gatherings in Chile, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference and the United Nations 2019 Climate Summit. Despite President Piñera's shakeup of his cabinet and the promise of an increase in pensions, affordable health care, lowering the price of medicine, and stabilizing electricity rates, protests have continued, with demands that the president resign. Protesters are also demanding that Chile's current Pinochet-era constitution be rewritten by a participatory constitutional assembly, laying the foundation for fundamental social change. Your reporter spoke with José Ragas, assistant professor at the Instituto de Historia at Chile's Catholic University in Santiago. Here he discusses the economic conditions that led to militant protests against inequality and demands for change in Chile.
Despite these kind of fantastic numbers to the outside, the truth is that the Chilean salary is very, very low. For example, it sometimes can reach maybe $450. And the pensions are very, very bad. So what most people are protesting against is against the how this system is creating a gap between the richest and between more and more people who are becoming poor. They cannot have decent pensions. They cannot, for example, afford healthcare. So because everything is privatized. And one important term that has emerged over these weeks in the protests is the term dignity, because people are reclaiming that. They want to have dignity in terms of their salaries, in terms of how they are going to retire and how they can provide education for their kids, and also how they can afford healthcare in case they get sick. Right. So the root of all of this is that how neoliberalism has become a pervasive system for Chileans, and how they are aware that this system is no longer working, and they want to change that, and they want a change of constitution in order to reform the economic system as soon as possible.
José, can you talk about some of the specific demands and changes in the constitution that the students and wider society who are out in the streets protesting, what do they want specifically? Can you mention a few of the items there?
Well, actually, there is no list with specific demands, because this movement, one of the main features of this movement is that it doesn't have leaders. It's a mass movement where all these different groups, they are converging into one single movement. So now, after 3 weeks of protests, now there's more clear that what everybody wants is a change of constitution, basically because they don't want a constitution that was born under a military dictatorship with Pinochet. They want a new constitution born as a new social pact.
Tell us a little bit about the repression that the protesters in the street are facing in Santiago, Chile, and other cities where the protests are taking place.
The repression has been very, very bad here, because the government decided to declare a state of emergency in the first week of protests, and then it was followed by a curfew, which didn't work well, and also didn't encourage more people to confront the police in open spaces. And people have been protesting and mobilizing peacefully, but the police have been doing use of a very brutal repression. For example, there are many, many civilians, many students who have lost their eye because of the attack of the police. Actually, today in the afternoon, for example, I was in my university, in my office, and we have to leave the campus because the police was throwing tear gas and was repressing the students inside the campus. So this is has been going on over the last weeks, and the police is using more and more brutal elements. For example, not only tear gas, they are using toxic water, they are using force, and sometimes they have been invading public spaces and terrorizing families and the civil society. So this is becoming very, very bad on a daily basis.
Jose, what is the potential for radical social transformation in Chile that could result from these massive protests and the very clear demands for change?
No, actually, it's amazing because I've been attending the protests over all this in the past 2 weeks. And actually, I went to one today, and you can see that it's amazing how people is showing this solidarity, how people is taking care of each other, and how they are more aware about the problems that Chile, that the country was hiding for a very long time in terms of economic inequality. So there is a great amount of energy that people is trying to channel into transform this into the country that they want, into a more kind of equal country, for not only for a group in particular, but for everybody. The thing is that, as we were saying a few minutes ago, is that how they can reach that, how can they convert that into a political agenda, and how they can make this happen in terms for a new constitution, right? Because this is our, you can see a lot of groups, a lot of organizations from, for example, families who are going to the marches, to the protest, to Mapuches, to indigenous groups, and also, for example, to senior citizens who are demanding pensions, but there are no leaders here. There is a lot of very good desire in order to change the country, but the agenda is not clear at all so far.
That was Jose Ragas, assistant professor at the Instituto de Historia at Chile's Catholic University in Santiago. For more perspectives on the massive protests in Chile, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Dar Jamal was a mountain guide in Alaska when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. He felt called to cover that conflict as a reporter and traveled to Iraq as an independent, unembedded journalist, filing reports from the front lines. More recently, he's covered another conflict, the climate crisis, examining how rising temperatures and extreme weather are affecting the planet, people, and other living things. In his new book titled The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption, he traveled to the far corners of the globe, from Alaska to Australia's Great Barrier Reef via the Amazon rainforest, in order to discover the consequences to nature and to humans of the loss of ice. Jamal was accompanied on his journey by climate scientists and people whose families live off the land, and are among the first to experience the impact of climate change in their daily lives. During his book tour, Jamal spoke at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut on October 28th. Because young people were in the audience, he chose not to go into the detail the book does about the gravity of the situation, but instead told stories and made analogies between the climate crisis and his career as a mountain guide. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was in the audience and brings us this excerpt of his talk.
One analogy that I like to use talking about what is a difficult thing to talk about is, I used to be a mountain guide up on Denali in Alaska. And now as a journalist who spent a lot of years studying this, and I've done my research and I've done my homework and I've talked with leading experts in all the areas that I covered in the book, knowing that we are in a crisis situation, the analogy that I like to use is let's pretend that we're up on Denali and say that some of you are in a group of like nine people, that me and two other guides, which is the standard size of a standard West Buttress trip on if you're going to climb Denali. And let's say we're up at high camp at 17,200 feet. It's a very barren, hard, cold place to be, but we're up there and we're getting ready to go to the summit. And then when you're up there guiding, every evening you get a phone call from the Park Service and it's the nightly weather report. Everybody on the mountain that has a radio and listens to that call, because that's going to determine, hey, can we go to the summit tomorrow? Is the weather going to be good? And when you're up there and you've spent a whole year preparing for a trip, you know, that's very important information for you. So the guides typically get the radio call and listen to the radio. It comes from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. In this scenario, I get the call and they say, okay, we got this massive storm that's built up. We've never seen anything like it. It's off the charts in all categories, wind speed, how much snow it's going to bring, all this energy. And it's coming your way so fast and you can't descend. You guys just have to stay put where you are. But at least you have a little bit of notice that this thing's en route. And just to let you know, and it's really, really scary. It actually looks really, really grim. You may not make it through it, but you need to know this information. So me then as a guide, would you not want me to tell you that information if you're in that group? Well, of course you would want to know, because then what we would do, and I would tell you, and then I would split the group up and say, okay, you three, you're going to be in charge of food and fuel and making, you know, figuring how much we have and let's get ready and how can we plan that out. And then, okay, you three, you're going to be in charge of double pulling the tents and reinforcing the snow walls surrounding the camp and really getting us ready in that way. Using the mountaineering analogy, what do you do with climbers who don't believe the weather report? Well, then they are not going to probably participate in the preparation process. I can assure you that if I'm lead guide and they're on my team, then that would be a pretty challenging situation. And I think the rest of the people that were actually actively involved, I think I'd rely on peer pressure in that immediate analogy, to be literal about it. There is a segment of the population that don't believe the climate crisis that's right in front of our eyes, despite the fact that there's 97.1% of all climate scientists on the planet get the climate crisis is upon us and it's human caused. And the vast, vast majority of the other 2.9% of climate scientists that don't agree with that, the vast majority of them are funded by fossil fuel interests. And that's extremely well documented by numerous, numerous journalists around the planet. So bottom line is, do believe what's right in front of your eyes. Do believe your intuition. And it is a weird thing to live in a country that where there is, I think, probably more than any other country on the planet, a very large degree of denialism. That said, all polls show, even conservative Republicans, the majority of them now accept that the climate crisis is real and that it is human caused. And so I feel like that's a good analogy for where we really are right now in this crisis. And, you know, wherever you are as far as how much you know or how little you know about it, is less important than, I think, how are we going to be during these times? And I think that as grim as a lot of the science is that's showing us how far along we already are and how much of a struggle this is going to become for all of us, no matter what we do or where we live on the planet, I feel like we are in a situation now where we have to rededicate ourselves to kind of getting down to the brass tacks. The time for kind of dilly-dallying around and thinking, oh, we have so much time or we can kind of make plans indefinitely into the future, that's a world that we don't live in anymore.
That was independent journalist Dar Jamal, author of the new book titled The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Learn more about Jamal's book and groups working to address climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Global Community Radio in Geneva, New York, WLSL in St. Leo, Florida, KPRI in Pala, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.